storm is coming. Our storm. And when it arrives, it will shake the universe.
Welcome to the Solar Storm. This is your host, Kyle Hunt, coming to you March 4th, 2018. Thank you so much for joining me here on RenegadeBroadcasting.com. Please check out all of the great shows here on the lineup and also head on over to RenegadeTribune.com. I know there is a lot going on in the world. You might be listening to this in the archives because the Oscars are on, and it's just such an amazing celebration. A whole lot of chosen child rapists there giving each other a high five and pretending like the abuse of women and starlets, right? That's where the scandal ends. No. It's much deeper, much darker. Check out BeyondPizzaGate.com for much more there. If you're not interested in what's going on at the Oscars, maybe you've been paying attention to what's happening at AIPAC and the lack of any real opposition from the alt-right, who can seem to find any other excuse to march, but just doesn't seem to be able to stand up to organized Jewry, probably because their Zog Emperor, God Emperor, is a part of that. And his representatives, his minions, have been attending for the past few years. He himself was there in 2016 before he became elected, and he just wooed that audience incredibly. Oh yeah, the Trump yarmulke was the top seller. Maybe you've been watching a lot of YouTube videos about the Parkland hoax. Wait, actually, no, you wouldn't find videos like that on YouTube because they have gone through a massive censorship campaign, and they're even nixing all of the controlled opposition as well. They've taken out a lot of people who I'd consider to be controlled opposition. Is it all part of the theater, or have they really just moved into a mode where they want to silence anything that seems to be going against their narrative? This is a communist clampdown. We have all sorts of corporations, government entities, politicians, crisis actors, all sorts of people out there, activists who are aiming to completely subvert the Bill of Rights, starting with number one and number two. And thus far, they have been wildly successful. Wildly. And Donald Trump goes along with all of it. They needed a right-winger in there to push forward this agenda. Otherwise, the white American men, with all those guns, the NRA members, they'd be causing a fuss. But what are they doing instead now? They're cheering it on, still. Running cover, especially within the controlled opposition alternative media. So, maybe you haven't really been paying attention to that. Maybe you've been looking into South Africa, where whites are having their land taken. Particularly white farmers, who have been under attack for many, many years. And others, well, they've put through, the South African government has put through new legislation, which has come from Julius Malema of the Economic Freedom Fighters, that says, we're going to steal your land and we're not going to even compensate you for it. And what has the Zog Emperor said about any of this? Nothing. The silence is deafening. Just amazing who we're ruled by and all of the scandals surrounding them. These people are illegitimate, and it's just absolutely frustrating. They're trying to induce learned helplessness. Just look at Bibi and Trump in particular, since AIPAC is going on right now. These two people are just so obviously filthy, but yet we're just supposed to accept that they have the final say. Especially Bibi. The most standing ovations anybody's ever gotten in Congress. And this guy has spied on us, stolen from us so many times, and it's admitted. These people are not our greatest ally. Anyway, I actually have two guests here tonight. Two guests, and we won't really be discussing any of the things I just brought up, so I got that out of the way. Someone, if you'd like a more in-depth analysis on some of these current events, please do listen to the roundtable that Heathen Vegan was kind enough to do last night. I really appreciate him stepping up and doing that, and going an extra half hour as well. My first guest here tonight will be talking about white farming. Now, we hear a lot about the farmers down in South Africa. Why don't we hear about white farmers around the world? This guest is named Misha Popov, and I will let him give a brief introduction of himself, since I'm actually not too familiar with his background. Misha, welcome.
Hey, Kyle. Great to be here.
Well, thanks for stopping by here for the hour, and I'm glad you were able to make it to discuss this topic, because it's not something I'm too familiar with. Now, I have a little garden, I have some animals, and I'd like to advance myself in the area of farming to actually be able to, well, be self-sustainable and then some, to be able to then bring products to the market. And it's something that has really gotten away from our people. White people used to really be close to the land, but not so anymore. And that's all been by design. But before we get too far into that, why don't you give us a little bit about your story?
Yeah, sure. Well, I grew up on a grain farm in Saskatchewan. I don't know if your listeners or yourself, if you know where Saskatchewan is, you have up on the board here, Dallas, Texas. That's where I live now. Saskatchewan's 40 hours straight north. And the beautiful cold weather up there, it's kind of like the Scandinavia and Northern Europe. We grow the best grain. We don't grow the most grain per acre, but we grow the best wheat, barley, oats. We don't grow any corn. It's just too damn cold. But we grow the best grain in the world. We're right on par with, you know, the northern grain belt of Eastern Europe, like Ukraine and such, where they for centuries have grown the best grain. So anyway, I grew up there, and my family became organic in the early 90s. And there was no such thing as organic, really, as far as any certifiers or grocery chains were concerned. But we did it anyway, because my family is a bunch of crazy Russians. And then I in 1998, I became a USDA contract organic inspector. And I throw the word contract in there just so your listeners know. There's no such thing as a government organic inspector. There's lots of farm inspectors who are bureaucrats who work for the government. But in the organic industry, sort of a badge of honor I like to share with people, I never worked for the government, either in Canada or the United States. We all of the organic inspectors in North America work on contract. We're independent. We bid on our work. You get a list of 20 or 50 farms to inspect over a period of a month, and you just go at it, and it's there's no better life. I really miss it. But in any case, while I was an inspector there, Kyle, for 5 years, working on both sides of the border in the United States and Canada, I started to notice farmers cheating. And so around 2000, 2001, I kept trying to deal with the certifiers that I was working for, and they weren't too interested. I quickly learned why. Well, the certifiers, this is one downfall of our private sector, I guess. They don't get paid if they decertify someone, you know? They only get their certification fees collected from a farmer or a broker, trader, or processor if the product being sold goes to market. And then they collect all sorts of fees. It's quite a lucrative business. So to have an inspector who's suspicious of something isn't good enough. You got to be absolutely sure someone's cheating before they would take any action, because they got a lot of money at stake. Basically, now the organic industry in America alone is worth more than Major League Baseball, Kyle. It's worth about $43 billion a year. And the certifying bodies, which work under accreditation from the United States Department of Agriculture, those certifying bodies are collecting royalties on that $43 billion. And so, as I say, it's quite lucrative.
And who ends up paying for all this at the end of the day?
The consumer. And so it's a lot like if you and your listeners are familiar with the kosher brand. You'll see kosher on a lot of food, and you think, well, why is cheese kosher? Are Jews big on cheese? But what happens is there's private certifiers. Even though it's overseen by the Israelis, the kosher label is all handled by private certifiers who hire private contract inspectors. In that case, the kosher thing is all handled by rabbis. And they go out and they'll certify. Basically, they're endorsing or blessing, if you will, your cheese. And they say, yeah, it's kosher now. Yay. And the argument they make when they go to a food maker is, hey, you don't want to alienate. Jews are like only 2 or maybe 3% of the consuming public. But yeah, you don't want to alienate 3% of the public. I mean, if you're a Fortune 500 company, you don't just blow off 3%. And we're seeing the same thing with Hillel in the Muslim world. But in any case, even if you're not Jewish, you're now buying kosher cheese and milk and butter. And yeah, like I say, those aren't even traditional Jewish foods. But so there's sort of the same thing happening in the organic industry. Who pays for it, Kyle? The consumer. Even if you don't want to buy organic food. And by the way, when you hear me talk here, you won't want to buy it. It's mostly fraudulent. But even if you don't buy it, you're paying for it, because this is all subsidized by the government. Even though I'm very proud to say I never worked for the government. Oh, whether it was George Bush, Obama, and I'm sad to say now Trump, they're just pouring money into the, you know, the poor little organic industry, which I remind you is worth more than Major League Baseball. But in terms of farming in North America, that's really just like 4% of total grocery sales. So, oh, the poor organic industry down there at 4%, we better help them out. And yeah, you're paying for it, whether or not you buy organic. And then heaven forbid, Kyle, if you do buy organic, then you're really paying. You're literally directly funding this temple to the green goddess Gaia of Mother Earth. And you're not getting anything that you think you're paying for. So there I was back in about halfway through my 5-year stint working as an inspector. I started to notice cheating.
What kind of cheating?
It wasn't serious, but there was nothing I could do about it, Kyle. Sorry, go ahead.
What kind of cheating were they doing?
Well, I was inspecting farms. I was just a low-level guy, so I'm on the farms. And as I worked my way up, I started to inspect processors. But I would notice really suspicious things, like a weed-free field. I mean, it's possible, right? But a weed-free field is pretty suspicious. Then I'd see things like a weed-free field, but there were weedy patches here and there. Sometimes you have low levels in a field where a slough used to grow, a little bluff of trees, while the farmer tears all the trees out so he can farm that land. But in wet years, the weeds really grow in those little low spots. And I'd see footprints and dead yellow weeds in these areas. I'd say, what the heck is this? And what it was is the farmer was going out probably at 2 a.m. and backpack spraying the weedy patch. And some of my fellow inspectors laughed at me, but I now live here in Texas. I have almost a 2-acre yard. I routinely spot spray for weeds with a backpack sprayer. I also have a pull-behind sprayer here for my little tractor, but I usually use the backpack sprayer because weeds don't grow, you know, from one end of a field to another. They're in little patches. Like I say, they find a little wet area or something, and so they kind of cluster. And yeah, so there was a spraying, and then there was co-mingling, where a farmer would just get non-organic grain and mix it in. if you know how to do your math properly, you'll catch that in the audit. And I'm not a big fan of paperwork, but you can catch a lot of cheating in the paperwork. But again, you go to the certifier who's working on behalf of the USDA in this case. And yeah, that certifier, they're like, well, that farmer paid us $25,000 in certification fees last year, Mr. Popoff. Are you absolutely sure? And to make a long story short, I would always say, well, let's do a test. Right, Kyle? Do a test. That's how you find out if Olympic athletes are cheating. That's how they catch people speeding on highways. You use technology to do some sort of scientific analysis, and they were not interested. And so I left the organic industry. Lo and behold, it grew by leaps and bounds. And I should say, when I was inspecting, you mentioned this in your intro. We used to all be farmers, right? Well, imagine back in the late 1990s, we weren't all farmers, but all the organic farmers were domestic. I mean, who even thought of importing any food from a place like China or Turkey, let alone organic food? Who even thought of that back in the 90s? No one. But as it grew and grew, your listeners won't believe this, Kyle, but we're at the point now where about 80% of the organic food sold in America is imported from China, Mexico, Turkey, and believe it or not, Iran. Iran is in there. And then you got your, you know, Brazil and Vietnam. And it's just crazy. So what they're doing, Kyle, is they're trying to undermine what few farmers here in America who are organic, they're trying to undermine them.
Question.
And I believe there's a racial component to it.
Interesting. Well, I have a question. Where is it getting inspected? Is it getting inspected, let's say, in China and then again in the United States? Are the inspectors in China ones from the United States? What kind of protections do the consumers have?
None. So here's how it works. It makes sense. There I was, a farm boy. I grew up and then I started inspecting farms in my area, and I spread out to the whole Midwest of America and Canada, because that was my background. That makes sense to have someone living there. Well, they sort of took that model to China. So what you have is trainers from America, and they belong to an organization called the International Organic Inspectors Association, and they're based in Montana. I used to be a member of the IOIA, that's their acronym. I was on their board as a senior member in my fifth year as an inspector. And what they do is they go over to China, the trainers, and they train Chinese inspectors to inspect their own food that's going to be shipped to America. But get this, it's not a Chinese certification. It's USDA certification. So you go to the grocery store and you'll pick up an apple, and it'll have the USDA organic logo. You know, they put little stickers on every last piece of fruit now. And you think, wow, this apple must have been, I don't know, grown in Washington or Oregon. No, it was grown in the Mekong Valley of China. Or it was grown in Turkey. We get a lot of organic pomegranate from Turkey. And good God, I've heard of organic pomegranate farmers here in America tearing down their pomegranate groves because they couldn't sell them. No one would buy them. But then here we are importing them from Turkey. And again, to ram the point home, they're getting USDA certification on those pomegranates and on those apples and on that flax coming from China and Turkey and Mexico. And we're training their own people to, quote unquote, inspect it. And that inspection, again, I remind you, there's no testing. It's all on paper. A good inspector will walk the field. That's what I always did. That's how I found footprints and dying weeds in some fields in North and South Dakota and in Saskatchewan and Manitoba. But if you're a lazy inspector, I mean, you're the inspector. There's no other inspector watching over you to make sure you actually get off your butt and look around. So the lazy inspector just looks at the paperwork and says, yeah. You know, what's that expression? Bob's your uncle. And there you go, with the stroke of a pen and some hefty fees paid to a for-profit certifying body, your product is now destined for America. Now, you asked, is it inspected when it comes into America? Only insofar as all food is subject to inspection. And you're looking at about 0.1%. The USDA or the the FDA, they have the authority to open containers coming in to America. But they don't focus on organic. They just, you know, every now and then they'll randomly open a container that, and it happens to be organic instead of non-organic. And so there's no extra scrutiny provided when the food comes in. So it was all certified on paper back in China before it even left the farm. And that's all USDA organic certification.
Now, to play devil's advocate a bit here, isn't that still safer than, let's say, what Monsanto is putting out there that's not organic? And people out there who are health conscious, they want to make informed decisions, and you're saying they don't have all the information, but they don't see much of an alternative. So could you talk to us a little bit about what the non-organic food is like, and if there are any alternatives, let's say local farmers markets, where you might be able to get some better, safer produce?
Yeah, you just nailed it. If you want something that's organic, you got to buy it local or buy it from a farmer you know, even if that's over the internet from a neighboring state and they're going to ship it to you. That's the only way. You have to be your own inspector. So you might go to a farmer's market. There's some fraud at farmer's markets too.
It's
called repackaging. We could get into that, but basically a farmer is paying for the table. 20 years ago, a table was free for any farmer in your local farmer's market. Now they're paying thousands of dollars for that table. Well, if they run out of carrots and their farm is called Joe's Carrots or Joe's Organic Carrots, guess what they're going to do? Or they might do. They might just go buy some carrots and repackage them and sell them to you. So you have to go a step further, Kyle. You have to meet the farmer. You'll meet them at the farmer's market. But then you got to go to their farm and you think, well, who the heck has time for that? Well, everyone should go to a farm once in their life, or at least once a year. Pack up the kids, meet the farmer, buy carrots from him, you know, 20 times in a row, and finally say, hey, can I come out to your farm? And maybe he'll have some really good excuses why you can't come to his farm. But the honest farmer, 9 times out of 10, he'll say, yeah, you want to come to my farm? you tell me when, and you can come out, especially if maybe you're going to pick some of your own carrots, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's the only way. And to some people, that sounds crazy, but you are not getting a safer product, safer than Monsanto or safer than anything, because it's the system is so rife with cheating. I used to compare it to the Olympics or the Major League Baseball, because there was a lot of cheating in the Olympics and Major League Baseball. But Kyle, I'll tell you, it's more like the Tour de France. The question isn't who's cheating. The question is who isn't cheating. Mm-hmm. If you've got 80% of the food coming in from overseas, and the poor people working on these Chinese, Turkish farms, they don't even know that they're working on a USDA certified organic farm. They just do what they're told. A lot of times they don't even own the land. And it's people higher up, the broker traders, who get all the paperwork done so it can be shipped to America. And you're not only not getting a safer product, you're often getting a dangerous product. And it was none other than the New York Times, Kyle. New York Times admitted this in a story that I've been quoting for the last year. To anyone who will listen, the rate of foodborne illness caused by organic food is double that of regular food.
Why?
Now, if that had come through some evil conservative website like, I don't know, Breitbart or Daily Caller, which I have written for, by the way, full disclosure, well, then maybe people would dismiss it. But it was the New York Times. And what's happening is the powers that be, they realize, you know, we got a problem here and there's no use hiding it. We should sort of let it out bit by bit, you know, so we can say, hey, well, we were open about it. There was a story on the front page of the New York Times a year and a half ago.
So why is this?
And it kind of covers their butts.
Why is organic food causing more foodborne illness than non-organic?
That's a great question. So first of all, there's so many ways to cheat. Most of the ways that you cheat aren't going to hurt anyone. You're just going to get ripped off. You think you're eating something organic and it was sprayed or a synthetic fertilizer was used. The way you get sick is when you, it's ironic, but it's when the farmer actually is following the rules, but then fails, and that's in your manure composting.
Okay.
So there's this farmer in Turkey, and he's up to his elbows in black dirt and manure. And if you don't fully compost manure properly, and then you apply it to a crop, the fecal pathogens can actually go right into the plant, and you can't wash them off now. There have been a few studies on that. It'll go right, it'll go into the stamen of the plant, into the cell structure of the plant. So the feces is in the plant. So the USDA is very strict on how you do your composting. And by the way, so your listeners know, composting is the heart and soul of organics. Long before anyone even invented the first pesticide or envisioned the first GMO crop, composting was the heart, and it was the rejection of synthetic fertilizers that started the organic industry, actually in 1917, the second last year of the First World War. And it was the Germans who both invented the synthetic fertilizer and started the organic movement. Kind of ironic, the Germans did both. But there you have it. That's the heart. And if you don't do that right, if you don't, for instance, follow the USDA guidelines on proper manure composting, you will literally kill people. And there have been deaths, there have been illnesses, and that's the answer to your question. It's improper feces handling.
Now, let's talk a little bit about fertilizer in general. And that's one of the reasons why people are so interested in having good organic fertilizer, because what they've put forth as industrial fertilizer has actually been toxic waste. I'm actually going to take out this break. We only have an hour with you, so we'll continue through here. Sure. Is there anything you could say about just fertilizers and whether or not inorganic or non-organic fertilizers are being used on organic farms?
Oh, there's no doubt that inorganic synthetic fertilizers are being used on organic farms. You can triple your yield by using synthetic fertilizers. So that's your synthetic nitrogen, which, as I say, the Germans figured out how to do it. They pull that out of the Earth's atmosphere. That's the same nitrogen, by the way, that we use in gunpowder. And that was discovered in 1917. And then they use what's called soluble phosphorus. So it's quick dissolving. And that's considered synthetic too, although all phosphorus comes from mined sources, whether it's organic or non-organic. And yeah, what happens, so there's the possibility that there's contamination in the process. And there have been theories, Kyle, that unscrupulous fertilizer sellers, they have to get rid of something, and they'll just put it in, you know, a few ounces per pound into a farmer's fertilizer, because that's a great way to spread it out over all these acres of land. I don't know any actual evidence of that, but your listeners won't be surprised. If it's something clandestine, don't expect the evidence. Sort of just assume human nature. If someone thinks they can make a buck spewing some toxic waste into a farmer's fertilizer, it's probably happening somewhere. But with that said, we don't see results of that. We don't see people falling ill. America has the safest food system in the world, and it is one of the most technologically advanced systems in the world. So most American farmers are using synthetic nitrogen and phosphorus. And then, of course, there's potassium and all your trace minerals, but those aren't organic or non-organic. Those are just fertilizers. They work on any type of farm. But it's those first two that are crucial. And the real problem let's just go with the first one, Kyle, with synthetic ammonium nitrate, that's your nitrogen fertilizer. The toxicity, if you will, is when you use so much because you want to make lots of money, and then it runs into waterways, and it'll choke out a lake. It's called hypoxia, and that robs the oxygen from a water body. Even the Gulf of Mexico has a hypoxic zone in it. I think last I heard it's 80 square miles.
It's called a dead zone. They call it a dead zone. And it's because the Mississippi is pouring in, and you've got all these farms going up north and spreading out. They're feeding into this, which is, it's all getting funneled right there into the Gulf of Mexico, and it's causing devastation. Yes.
And it's causing devastation along the way. There are lakes and streams. that used to have fish and crawfish in them. Not anymore, because it robs the oxygen. And yes, that's a dead zone. Exactly. And you can see it from the air. So I would shy away from suggesting that there's any industrial fertilizer that's actually harming people in terms of their diet and their health. It's the environment, and it's a huge, it's not just some hypothetical thing. It is huge. So if you use natural nitrogen, which you get from composting, it's less likely to leach out. It's also impossible to use too much of it. If you use this much nitrogen last year and you made this much money and you think, well, I'll just double that and I'll make double the money, that's actually possible in the synthetic side of the equation. That's impossible on the organic side. You couldn't compost enough manure and spread it on your market garden to even increase the nitrogen from last year by 10 or 20%. I mean, you're never going to double it. And if you did, if you had so much manure and you properly composted it, so it was safe. And also, when it's safe, Kyle, it's also more available to the plants. So there's a double payoff there. But if you did that, yeah, even if you doubled it, it's natural. It's going to stay in the soil, or at least more likely. There have been some studies that even natural nitrogen leaches into waterways. But good God, there's been natural nitrogen in the soil for thousands of years. And there were never any dead zones anywhere on the planet until we had modern farming.
And one of the things that's really fueling all of this toxicity in the waterways is the amount of farming that needs to be done to feed all of the animals, because Americans eat so many animals, and those animals need to eat huge, huge fields, usually of monoculture. So this is what has really created this catastrophe, this environmental anomaly that should not exist when you're actually doing farming. Right.
Well, but Kyle, there's two other things to throw in there. And that's sugar. Most of our sugar is now coming from corn. So again, yes, whether it's corn for the beef market for hamburgers, or corn for corn syrup for all the soda pop and garbage we eat. And then the third one is, of course, the ethanol industry, which is, again, subsidized to the hilt. Only Ted Cruz had the guts to say anything negative about the ethanol industry. But those three things, you're absolutely right. Beef is very significant. The best beef is grass-fed range beef. It's best nutritionally and for flavor. But you're right. They're stuffing cows and pigs and chickens with corn. And then you get the other two factors I mentioned, the sugar industry and the ethanol industry. And, yeah, well, all of that is being fertilized to the hilt, all up and down the corn belt, and it's killing our waterways.
I don't eat animal products. I do have now some chickens, which is for the manure, and also as pets here, because that's one of the really only ways that we're able to be sure about what we're putting in our soil. And I also, I think it's very important that people are close to either the animals that they're getting their eggs from. We're not going to be eating ours, but I feel like that's probably the only way you could be sure, if you're concerned about ethics, that you're getting ethical eggs, is by getting them yourself or going to a place that sells eggs, and you can see how the chickens look, how they're treated. But this would extend also to people who eat meat, and they want to make sure that they're getting healthy meat that wasn't completely from abused animals, throughout their life, and have barely seen the sun, let's say. So yeah. Is there anything you could say about the organic meat industry?
The organic meat industry is really a sliver of the 4% total organic grocery sales. It's almost insignificant. It goes in fits and starts. Every now and then you'll see, I don't know if you shop at Costco or Walmart, but you'll see sort of a big push on organic chicken thighs, and you'll wonder, well, where's the rest of the chicken? And I don't know. But then you'll go back next week and they don't have any organic chicken at all. And it's in fits and starts. And the reason is you really need a whole infrastructure built up for meat. like, it's easy to get vegetables and grains to market. Vegetables, boom, they go straight to market. Grains go through a flour mill and then a bakery, and then next thing you know, you're eating bread. But meat is a little more involved. And to make a long story short, every step has to be certified if it's certified organic. So again, that's easy for vegetables. If the market garden is certified, you're done. It's those vegetables are going into your hand next Saturday at the farmer's market. But meat, you got to certify the pasture, the cow giving birth to the calf. The feed has to be certified organic. And then, of course, then usually meat goes, if it's beef, it goes through stages. You have the calving, and then the feeder stage, and then backgrounding, and then finally the feedlot. And the feedlot is the culprit here, getting back to our earlier discussion, Kyle. That's where all that corn is pumped into the cow. And some cows, if they're not slaughtered within days, they're going to die on their feet because their liver gets blown out from all this high protein, high sugar corn. And they were living a diet on grass their whole life. Although some animals are being fed corn even earlier in their life. But in any case, cows aren't really supposed to eat corn at all. So
they'd never do it in the wild. Absolutely never. And all these people are worried about, oh, soy. Yeah. Soy is, you know, the big evil. That's why, you know, these vegans or vegetarians have it wrong. But the fact of the matter is most of the soy products that are being marketed out there are actually so-called organic. But it's the non-organic soy that's being fed to all of these cows. Let's say just the average beef that somebody gets. It's been fed soy and GMO corn its whole life.
Yeah. Yeah, not organic, right? Yeah. Yeah. So back to organic cows. Again, there's not a lot of organic meat, but there's a lot of organic dairy. Now, speaking of soy and corn, guess where all that feed is coming from? It's no coincidence. Again, the figure is around 80%, Kyle. 80% of the organic feed for the American organic dairy industry is coming from overseas. China, Turkey, Mexico, Brazil. Because very few farmers are growing it here. Now the organic activists, they claim, oh, those poor American farmers, they couldn't grow their organic soy because their neighbor was growing GMO soy. And they claim that the GMO soy poses a threat to the organic. And that's totally not true. We live in America, Kyle. If I'm pushing a shopping cart and I bump the door of your car, you're going to make me pay for it. And if I hurt you, you're going to sue me. And if I hurt one of your kids, you're going to, right? We're a litigious society. So whenever you hear this myth that the American organic farmer was squeezed out of the soy or corn or canola business because of GMOs, it's not true, because they would have sued for it, right? You have no right to put anyone out of business. And if you read the standards, you'll see I'm right. There's no such thing, in fact, as contamination of an organic field by a GMO field. You can contaminate a field by having your spray drift over the fence line. And you could contaminate a field that isn't even organic. What business, if you're spraying your crop, what business do you have with your spray drifting over onto my crop? And so there have been a lot of lawsuits for that, for spray, but none for GMOs. And just in passing, I'll mention, you mentioned Monsanto before. I have zero respect for Monsanto. What they've done is they have stolen the technology of genetic engineering. I'm sort of ambivalent on GMOs because of this. I'm a fan of technology, of any technology. It could be used for good or bad. It could be misused. And so I'm not even going to go through the list of GMO crops and tell you which ones are good and which ones are bad. The point is, Monsanto has deliberately monopolized that, along with another company called Bayer. Bayer bought out two or three competitors. And there was talk that Monsanto might even merge with Bayer, so they'd be this huge, giant monopoly. Well, they have stolen this technology. Again, whether it's good or bad, I'm sure you'll agree there's at least potential there where the science of genetic engineering could be used for good. They stole it. It's theirs now. No one else can play. If you want to play, if you have a little startup, and maybe you got, you know, your PhD in bioscience, forget it. Your only hope is to get whatever product you come up with, is to get the attention of Monsanto or Bayer, and hopefully they'll buy you out. Because it's going to cost $150 million just to get your GMO crop through the regulatory process. That's just paperwork, Kyle. That's not field testing or field trials or feeding it to rats or any of that stuff. That's all lab stuff that you'll pay for. So, you know, you're looking at about $500 million. I'm not kidding you, to bring a GMO to market. And so even though I'm a fan of technology, I'd just as soon let all of the existing GMO crops just fall by the wayside.
Yeah, and I feel like we've done well enough as people, especially as white people, with just, you know, crossbreeding different crops and just, you know, doing it the old-fashioned way without having to get out the microscopes and the test tubes, let's say. You know, obviously, there are some things that potentially could be done of benefit in a lab. I'm not going to say that's not possible, but we need to take control back of our food, and we need to stop having the government meddle with all their subsidies and with all their deals. And what you're saying here is that the organic farmer isn't failing because of his GMO neighbor. It's oftentimes because of being undercut by the overseas corporations that are shipping in the organic foods. And really, it's very hard to compete with a country like China when they're being given complete unfettered access to the American consumer, and you're just a little guy. So is there anything else you could say about that? And also about the corporations that will use these big farms that will use all of these Mexican laborers. And this also applies to slaughterhouses, of course, like Shalom Rubashkin's, the Chabad Lubavitch kosher slaughterhouse operator, who moved a lot of meat, and there was a whole lot of fraud and abuse that went on there. And actually, Trump commuted his sentence. But you know, what can you say about the illegal laborers and the other ways that American farmers and just regular workers are being undercut and exploited?
Yeah. Well, in general, the whole idea that we need illegal immigrants to pick our fruit is absurd. We used to pick our own fruit. I mean, we used to all be farmers, but even when you get into the early years of the last century, and then the 1920s and 30s, we were still always picking all of our own fruit. You didn't get that racial term wetback. You didn't get that until Eisenhower after World War II, because a lot of people were so excited about winning the war and America was flush with cash. They thought, well, hey, I'm not going to go pick fruit. I'm going to go get a job in the city. And so a lot of the farmers started bringing up illegal labor. That's really where I'm sure it was going on before, Kyle, but we are farmers. I mean, that's, I don't know if you read the Bible, that you're big on the whole Christian thing, but like I always tell my wife, whether you believe it or not, the story is, as soon as Adam and Eve were kicked out of the Garden of Eden, they were farmers. That was their curse, if you will. God said, you must now toil on the land. There's going to be no more free food for you. You are now a farmer. And again, whether someone believes that's literally true or not, that's the story of Western culture. And to tell someone now, especially someone who's unemployed, to tell someone, yeah, you sit there, don't go pick fruit. It's an insult to that person and to Western culture itself. Now that's the general, I would say, about this whole illegal, farmhand thing. It's just BS. I mean, I think a lot of people would love to work on a farm. They would love that. They'd love to get up at the crack of dawn, kick their drug habit, you know, whatever problems they have in their life, and just kind of, it would be like boot camp for them to just see what farm life is like. I think a lot of them would love it. They would just, they'd turn their back on their life of debauchery. But Kyle, now to the organic industry. Well, the organic people, they really nailed this. You don't hear about illegal farm labor in the organic industry because, as we said earlier, they're just bringing it all in from overseas. So it's not really illegal if a Mexican farmhand works on a Mexican organic farm in Mexico. And remember, the final icing on the cake, if you will, is when that organic, so-called organic product comes up from that Mexican farm, it bears the USDA organic logo on it. So who in his right mind would even think that, you know, that maybe this is imported? It says USDA. What's happened is the USDA decided under Bill Clinton, and it was actually under Jewish Secretary of Agriculture, Dan Glickman, no less, and Bill Clinton made sure to team him up with a Muslim guy over in the Department of International Trade. I think his name was Siddiqui, but Siddiqui just fell by the wayside. You still see Dan Glickman in the news, Jewish Zionist Dan Glickman pushing organics. Oh, yeah, it's great. It's great. And what they did was they allowed the USDA organic logo to become just a brand that anyone in the world could rent. You can rent it on a part-time basis. It's usually on an annual basis. If you're a farmer, you will, if you're in China, you phone up the Chinese certifying body. And remember, they have inspectors who are trained by the International Order of Organic Inspectors from Montana. And those Chinese inspectors will come out to your farm. And I don't know, maybe you bribe them. Who knows how the Chinese do their business. But one way or another, you'll pay your fees, you'll get the paperwork, and that product will be shipped to America. So just to conclude this, that little piece of this conversation, the leaders of the organic industry have skirted the whole issue of illegal farm labor. So they can stand and say, hey, we're not like those guys. We don't abuse, you know, poor Mexicans coming up over the border who just want a better life. No, no, no. Well, of course you don't, because you're abusing them right there in Mexico, and you're abusing the farmhands right there in China. I mean, Chinese people don't even own their own land, for God's sake. So yeah, they. I think it's worse, is what I'm saying. I think it's worse the way the organic industry is doing it, and they're doing it all under the watchful eye of the USDA.
Yeah, it really has just become this branding gimmick, and it's effective. People are willing to pay more. I know I've done this many times in my life. I've paid more because it's hard to trust anything that you're consuming these days unless you're doing it yourself. And even then, as I've mentioned with some of these fertilizers, do you really know what's going into your organic seed from the ground? What about the water that we're spraying it with? So it's very, very difficult. And we just try to make the best decisions available to us. And that's why we look at these labels. Another one that is everywhere now is the non-GMO project. Is there anything you can say about the non-GMO label and what kind of process they go through?
Yeah, it's really ironic. As I said earlier, GMOs don't bother me. It's the two, we're down to two companies now that control the whole field of science of genetic engineering. Imagine controlling a field of science. They don't just control a market. They control a field. If you're, like I say, if you're going to university studying biotechnology, you're either going to be the next Bill Gates who turns this whole thing upside down, or you're just going to end up working for Monsanto or Bayer. So anyway, so that's the with GMOs. The irony is, there's, I think it was really Whole Foods that sort of pioneered it, the non-GMO project, but now you got everyone involved in it. And again, you're just buying a label, you're buying a brand to put on your product temporarily. You pay a certifying body that'll send an inspector out and basically do paperwork. But here's the irony. If you read the standards for the non-GMO project, right in there it says, hey, we might even do a test to make sure the product is indeed entirely GMO free. Well, isn't that ironic? Because they will not test organic product, which by its nature is built right in, is non-GMO. I mean, there always was a non-GMO label on the market. It's called organic. It's been there, you know, since the 1990s here in America, and it was passed by law by Congress in 2002. But no, not good enough. We got organic, which is supposed to be non-synthetic fertilizer, non-pesticide, and non-GMO. But we're going to go ahead and we got this other label now. So you'll see products with two or three or four little logos on them. It could have kosher, non-GMO, certified organic by the USDA, blah, 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 boom, boom, boom. And they're all meaningless, really. I mean, again, I'm just not worried about GMOs like some people. It's the way they're handled. So if I'm going to buy something organic, I'm going to go to a farmer, like I said earlier. You have to be your own eyes and ears. And you, Kyle, ask yourself, do you think I even asked that farmer if that organic product might be GMO? Do you think I right. even crosses my mind? It's not even in the mix when you're talking to a farmer who's honest, right? You might ask him, how do you do your manure composting? You know, is it safe? Can I feed your carrots to my kids? And he'll show you, yeah, here's the manure pile. And I turn it every 30 days, just like the standards say. And, well, great, good job. You won't even ask him if he's using GMO seed, because you know before you even ask, the thought even enters your mind. You know it's the furthest thing from that farmer's mind.
Misha, you mentioned something to me prior to the show about these urban activists pushing organic. Is there anything else you want to say? I don't know if you already covered that topic, or are these kind of community groups within these cities that are basically selling their people a false bill of goods?
Yeah. Remember I said earlier, when the organic industry really started in the late 1990s, 100% of it was domestic. And 100% of the people in the room, the committees, the bylaw committees, remember I was on the board of my inspectors association, 100% of the people were American, or at least Canadian in my case. The people were also domestic, and we were all farmers. Now, oh my goodness, you get the boards, like the USDA has the National Organic Standards Board. I think there's one farmer out of 12 or 15 people, one farmer. And it's not really a farmer. It's someone with a corporate farm, and they never get their hands dirty. And I don't even know, maybe they grew up on a farm, but they're certainly not a farmer now. They don't know how to start the tractor, probably. So yeah, the organic industry, quite unlike the conventional industry. If you go to any farm bureau or a commodity group like the wheat growers, it's all farmers. You walk in the door, the receptionist isn't a farmer, but everyone else is. But the organic industry, it's hard to find the farmers, just like it's hard to find the domestic farms these days. So yeah, it's all being run by urban activists. And on that note, these urban activists, a lot of them are double or triple dipping. They'll have an interest in a certifying body, so they're making money. They'll also have an interest in a brokerage of some sort. And then there they are sitting on top of that on the National Organic Standards Board in Washington, D.C., getting, first-class tickets to come in and have meetings two or three times a year. And, they don't care if there's fraud. They're looking for volume. So they're at 4% right now. Their goal is to reach 15%. Now, remember, 80% of their organic food is being imported. And we know that because only 0.7% of the farmland in America is organic. So we don't even have the land that's certified to provide, even 20%. It's actually a low estimate to say 80% is imported. And they're fine with that. And if the amount of American farmland didn't increase and they went from 4% to 8% to 10% of the total grocery sales in America, they'd be totally fine with that because they're not farmers. It's just business for them. Now, again, so you got your cattlemen, your wheat growers, and yeah, those guys, they got their problems because, as we said earlier, their nitrogen is destroying waterways, but at least they're farmers. And Kyle, if you sat down with one of them and had a beer and said, you know, geez, could you guys cut down on the fertilizer? The guy would actually listen to you. But if you try to talk to the organic industry about how much food we're importing, they'll just call you a racist. Plain and simple. You're just a racist.
Misha, we've just about we've just about run out of time. Is there anything else you'd like to say just about the white cultural heritage aspect of all this, and also what people can do to ensure that they're getting safer food? We mentioned some things before about going to these farmers. I've been milling my own grain, which I get in these big buckets to make the flour that I make here. So if people make your own bread, Make your own bread. It's a rewarding experience. It's going to be much, much better. And it might take some time and investment. But that's one suggestion from me. Better what you're putting in your body and the bodies of your family. Anything in these closing minutes here?
Yeah. Farming does always have a racial component. I mean, why are people starving in Africa? It's a cultural thing. Africans just don't make great farmers. Asians do very well with farming. I wouldn't say they're better. You know, you often hear that white people have a higher IQ than black people, but then Asians have an even higher IQ and they get all the good jobs with, in science and technology. But when it comes to farming, I'd put Asians and white people on par. But for some reason, black people just, they can't get it. And how long have they been starving? Is it longer than you and I have even been alive? It's not a new thing. And the only saving grace in some countries like South Africa was when white farmers came in and made the land productive. Well, now they're killing their white farmers.
Yeah. And in the case of Zimbabwe, In Zimbabwe, they just slaughtered them, ran them off, and now they're celebrating getting them back finally. They've got a few of them to come back so that they can help save the country.
Right, but guy like me, I'm the racist because I'm asking why our flax comes from China. You know, what's wrong with Chinese people? Nothing, but I'm sure there's a flax farmer right there in Ohio who could grow it for you. They need white farmers, and they call us the racists, and it's crazy. But again, to draw this analogy back to the organic industry, the organic industry, the urban leaders. Kyle, they knew they weren't going to drive white farmers out the way that Robert Mugabe drove white farmers out of Zimbabwe, you know, at the barrel of a gun. But they did something even worse in a way. I mean, no farmers were harmed in the process, but yeah, they just pulled the rug out from under the American organic farmer by going to China, Turkey, Brazil, Mexico. And okay, maybe it's not worse. I guess no one wants to be pushed around at the barrel of a gun, but you can see what I'm saying. There's a parallel there.
Misha, thanks so much for coming on here. We've run out of time. I know this is a lot of new information out there for our listeners, so we'll all be processing it, and perhaps we'll be able to speak to you again soon.
All right.
Thanks again. Stay tuned, everyone. Second hour coming up.
Need those extra shekels? Well, join Juba. Juba, with their Jewish partners, the Italian Coast Guard and other NGOs, are recruiting now. We require sea taxi transporters to pick up Negroes out of the Mediterranean. The more bodies, the greater the pay. No sat-nav required. It is a one-way fare, and that is northwards to Europe. So join Juba today. Let's increase white genocide and make those shekels on the side. Juba, the transportation company.
Renegade Broadcasting, hard-hitting talk radio.
Welcome back to Renegade Broadcasting. This is Kyle Hunt of the Solar Storm, and this is Hour 2. I should be having another guest here with me tonight to talk about an interesting topic that I don't really know all that much about, and that would be North Korea. I know some of the basics, but I've never been there, and we really don't have a good understanding of what it's like there. My guest actually has been there, so we're going to hear about his experiences there. We'll see if this is him. Hello, caller. Who's this? Oh, wait one moment. Yeah, no, caller, welcome. Are you there?
Kyle?
Yes.
This is John.
Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well, thanks. So, please give the audience a little bit about your background and also what you're going to be talking about here tonight, which is North Korea.
Okay, you know, Kyle, this is my first time tuning into your program, so I kind of don't know the format. I've jotted down a bunch of points. If you want to interrupt me and ask questions, that's fine. I'm just wondering, are people going to be calling in and asking questions?
They might, and we can hold that off for the later segment.
Okay. All right, you asked me about my background. I'm 64 years old. I'm a retired oil truck driver from Long Island. I have traveled to 97 countries all over the world. My job was a seasonal job. As I said, I'm retired. So I had the luxury of taking summers off and just traveling all over the world. Most of my traveling was done when I was younger, but I have gone away now and then in the past 15 years. And in 2013, 5 years ago, I made a 7-week trip to Eastern Asia. The first 6 weeks, I just traveled on my own on public transport through Cambodia, Vietnam, and China. And the last week, since there's no independent travel allowed in North Korea, I had booked a tour, and I spent 1 week in North Korea. And, you know, I would like to start off by just reading a little excerpt from Orwell's 1984. I think that'll really set the mood, because I think I read this book when I was in high school 50 years ago. I have the same old battered paperback copy, and the more I look back at it, more relevant it seems to become because of what the media has done to our mind. Anyway, let me just read a couple of sentences here that I really think apply to North Korea. War prisoners apart, the average citizen of Oceania never sets eyes on a citizen of either Eurasia or East Asia, and he is forbidden the knowledge of foreign languages. If he were allowed contact with foreigners, he would discover that they are creatures similar to himself, and that most of what he has been told about them is lies. The sealed world in which he lives would be broken, and the fear, hatred, and self-righteousness on which his morale depends might evaporate. Now, I think that is very applicable to North Korea, especially the line about they are creatures similar to himself, and that most of what he has been told about them is lies. Now, I think everybody's image of North Korea is pretty much what, I don't have a TV set. I threw my television set in the trash about 15 years ago, but I know every time North Korea comes up on the news, all you see is marching, goose-stepping soldiers, missiles, parades, that kind of thing. Kim Jong-un doing his thing. And when you go to North Korea, you're not going to see that. Maybe you might. If you're there on two or three national holidays, you'll see parades, that kind of thing. But what you'll see, and another thing is, I don't know, you know, we've heard all these horror stories about slave labor camps and prison torture and hundreds of thousands of political prisoners. I mean, that might be true. I think some of it is true. I think some of it is not true.
Hey, that happens all the time in China, yet they're our greatest trade partner.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. Plenty of slave labor there. You know, another thing I want to mention, I don't want to get too much off the subject here, but I know you're familiar with the book Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Jim Fetzer.
When I first heard about that book, I said to myself, this you know, I know the media lies about everything, but I said to myself that they cannot possibly pull something off like this. So, but my curiosity got the better of me, and I ordered the book. I read the book, and all I have to say about it is that a lot of it is very convincing, and some of it I'm not convinced. And what I got to thinking about was, you know, what the main thesis of this book, or let me just say the main argument, the biggest argument is that he said that that school was closed for 4 years prior to the shooting or alleged shooting. You're familiar with that, right? That he said the school was closed?
I've heard him say that many times, yes.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't really followed up on all the developments with that. I know you have updated that. I really haven't followed up. But the way – what I've learned in my life is that I – you know, we are just bombarded with so many lies that all I can believe anymore is what I see with my own eyes, and that's primarily what I see with my own eyes, and secondarily what nobody disputes. So I got to thinking – the people who really know the truth about what happened at Sandy Hook are going to be the people that live on that block, Dickinson Drive, or near it. Now, they would know in the last, between 2008 and 2012, when the school was said to be closed, they would know if they saw school buses rolling in and out, if they saw parents dropping their kids off and picking them up. You know, if they saw that, then I really cannot believe anything in this book. On the other hand, if they didn't see that, if they knew that the school was abandoned, then I think the media has pulled off.
Who says those people have any credibility, though? That could be a spook town.
I don't know.
Do you know how the CIA?
I live 100 miles away. Sometimes I'm tempted to just go up there and knock on doors and ask people. At this point in my life, I'm 64 years old. I just want to know the truth about things.
Right.
I have no axe to grind. I don't know.
It seems like there are certain towns, and Newtown would be one of them, where you have a lot of people, let's say, from Israel. You've got Jewish actors like Gene Rosen who are taking in children who I guess that's part of their emergency protocols. They just drop these children off at the local Jewish actor's house. How ridiculous is that? That would never be what happens. Gene Rosen wouldn't just be taking in children from the bus stop. This is absolutely absurd. So many things that don't add up. When you look at how the CIA has certain towns set up, so they're able to control things very tightly. I start to see these patterns, and I think, some of these people who are coming forward as eyewitnesses don't actually have any credibility. But I understand what you're saying, and it's hard for us to believe anything. A lot of it is just theater. In my own opinion, and this is an opinion of somebody who's never even come anywhere close to North Korea, what we're being shown with North Korea is essentially some kind of WWE theater. And that, let me just state that to begin with. I think that Kim Jong-un is not necessarily an independent actor. At the same time, I also recognize that he's not the monster villain that he's been portrayed as, and that country and its people are not our greatest enemy. They've actually never really done anything to me or my people. However, when you look at the history of the United States waging war on North Korea, well, that is a different story. There is good reason for the North Korean people to hate the Americans. Some estimates put it about 20% of the North Korean population was killed in the Korean War. This was indiscriminate bombing using incendiary bombs and other ones. About 600,000 tons of bombs.
Yes, I was going to bring that up, and I'm glad you brought it up first.
So the point is they destroyed the country.
Another point about Korea is that in their entire history, going back 2,000 years, something like that, they have, as far as I can determine, they have never ever attacked a foreign country. I mean, the North did invade the South in 1950, but they have never bothered anybody else. But anyway, I brought up Sandy Hook. Again, it's pretty irrelevant to what we're talking about. But again, what I see with my own eyes, what those people saw there, that's besides the point now. But let me just say this off the bat. Going to North Korea, I'll tell you two things. Number one, yes, it is a very repressive country. I've been to a lot of places. I can compare it to a lot of other countries. It is very repressive. That's number one. Number two, as you probably know, Americans can't go there now, thanks to Trump. as of September 2017. But it is a very, very safe and welcoming country. I cannot think of another country of the 97 I've been to, maybe Iran, where I have never felt so welcome as an American citizen. Now, they do have a tremendous amount of hostility against the U.S. military and the government, of course. And you'll see that. I mean, there are posters. There are things you can buy in some of the shops there. But as far as an ordinary American going there, I mean, I was in a group of 17, there were 19. There were seven Americans, and we were all treated absolutely first class. Now,
were you vetted?
Go ahead.
What was the vetting process for you to get in there? And did the U.S. government, whether the consulate or whatever, give you any issues about going to North Korea?
No, back then it was beginning in January 2010 and up to September of last year, as I said, about 7.5 years, it was perfectly legal for American citizens to go there. They broke the North Koreans, changed their policy in January of 2010. And my best guess is roughly 1,000 American tourists a year went there, a total of about 6,000 or 7,000 in those 7.5 years. So it was really not. You have to go to a tour group I booked with Young Pioneer Tours. They're a China-based company, but they're run by the guy who runs it is British, and they're basically the crew there is basically from the English-speaking countries, Ireland, England, New Zealand, Australia. So I booked through them, and they were an excellent company, and It was not a problem. All I had to do, it was very easy actually. I just had to scan the details of my passport, and they took care of the rest. They arranged the visa. You know, they arranged the air ticket. Everybody has to, actually Americans at that time, in fact, in all the time that Americans were allowed to go there, we were the only nationality that had to fly in. Other people had to, they had a choice between taking the train from Beijing to Pyongyang, the capital, or flying in. It's a 90-minute flight. So,
it would seem like North Korea would be worried about U.S. spying operations, which would then lead me to think that they'd have you closely watched or at least chaperoned in some degree. Was there any of that from your perspective? Could you tell you were being watched or analyzed?
No,
or did you have to be?
Not at all. There's a couple of rules that you have to follow. And you know, everybody's a little bit nervous about going there the first time. I'll admit I was a little bit apprehensive. So the day before in Beijing, we all met that there was like three tour groups, about a total of about 50 people. And we just all met at a hotel in Beijing at a bar. Everybody had a couple of beers. I had a lot of questions. And a couple of special rules do apply. And it's very simple. I mean, if you want to get into trouble there, it's very easy to do so. But if you want to, it's just as easy just to have a great time and avoid trouble. Basically, the special rules are you cannot criticize or show any displays of respect towards the regime. You cannot wander off on your own. You have to stay with the group, although there is a little bit of latitude. And the other thing was taking photos. You were required to ask if there was anybody around in uniform yet. You were required to ask first. But they were very lenient about the photos, I have to say. And there were a couple of rules about electronics. You know, I'm probably the last traveler in the world. I don't bring any electronics with me, so that I wasn't too worried about that. But let me just give you, it's really kind of it's such a unique destination. It's such a unique place to go to. So let me just give you, try to imagine if you can, taking off from you're leaving the airport in Beijing. The airport in Beijing is huge. It's like a huge bustling airport. You know, just like New York or Chicago or L.A., you know, flights taking off and arriving from around the world every 10, 15 minutes. And you fly to Pyongyang, and all of a sudden you touch down and you feel like you're in a ghost town. I mean, there's like nothing going on there. There were like three small planes just parked on the tarmac going nowhere. And it's kind of a very eerie feeling once you get there. And let me just tell you my very first impressions, because this will always last with me. We got out of the plane. There was about 90 people on the plane. There were about, I would say, 50 tourists and maybe 40 Chinese businessmen. And our leader was an American, believe it or not, a guy named Chris White, demolitions expert that did jobs around the world. And he just did, he freelanced doing tours for Young Pioneer Tours for a few years. He's not there anymore. In any event, we got off the plane. It was a hot day. It was in August of 2013, hot summer day. And, you know, everybody's a little bit jittery. Here we are in North Korea. And this is my very first impression. We followed Chris into the terminal building, and there was a North Korean security guard outside. And Chris had a carton of Camel cigarettes with him. As I found out later, the North Koreans love American cigarettes, Camels and Marlboros. And he just walked up to him, and the guy breaks out in a big smile, and they greet each other like long-lost friends. So this was like Chris's fifth or sixth tour there. And as soon as I saw that guy smile, I just felt kind of relieved. I said to myself, there's nothing to worry about here. And I'll give you one other thing that happened when we walked into the terminal. Now, the terminal, it was nothing like Beijing. It looked like an old, dilapidated Greyhound bus terminal, really small building, run down. There were exactly four flights, two flights arriving that day and two flights departing, and they were written by hand. So you can imagine the difference, the difference in atmosphere coming from Beijing. Now, we were told, as I said, we had a meeting the day before. We were told no photo. If you see anybody in uniform, you have to ask permission first. So what does one American woman in our group do? She, as soon as we get into the terminal building, there's five North Korean security guys standing against the wall, just looking on impassively. She takes out her camera and she starts snapping pictures right in the terminal building. So one of the security guards walks over, and I said to myself, oh boy, here it comes. All he did, he tapped her on the shoulder. He put up his hand like in a gesture, you know, with his palm out, stop. So she put her camera away, and that was the end of it. And then we all just went through custom. You know, there were just a couple of random bag searches, very, very quick routine. Then we were on our way to the hotel in Pyongyang, and we got there, and the Hotel Yanggakdo, which is where just about all tourists stay. And I'll tell you, you know, just the magical feeling of being in a place like this, a place where very, very few people go. Everybody's scared to go. And a place that really is truly isolated from the rest of the world. There's no internet or the telephone connection to the outside world. Well, you can call, tourists can call from the hotel, but that the ordinary people have no phone connection or internet connection to the outside world. But we were in that hotel, and I said, wow, you know, here I am, North Korea. I can't believe it. And it was the hotel was very pleasant, actually. It was very busy on the main floor. There were a lot of people checking in, a lot of people checking out. And the people at the desk were very polite. And, you know, as I found out, the people who work in the tourist industry there are probably the happiest people in North Korea. They're just so happy to have some interaction with, you know, with people from foreign countries. And it was just very, very pleasant. And there was really absolutely nothing to worry about. Nothing about the room being bugged or here I'm being watched as an American. Nothing like that at all. That's just a lot of baloney.
Well, at least not that you could see.
Well, you know, if there was, like I said, all you got to do is follow the rules, and there's really nothing. Now, all this paranoia, I don't know. Do you want me to read? I 9 months after I came back, if you want me to read, I'll give you an example of the kind of propaganda and the kind of scare tactics employed by the government. Do you want to share some of that?
Because I don't watch TV either, and I only get some different headlines about the fear mongering and oh, they want to just nuke America, and they're he's the most evil dictator. He's the new Hitler.
Yeah. No, I totally agree with that, and those stories, by the way, go back. You know, I was on the internet the other day. There was a story in January of 2003. The same, his father, Kim Jong-un's father, Kim Jong-il, I should say. He was going to do the same thing in 2003.
Axis of evil, right?
And he was going to unleash smallpox on us. I mean, this nonsense goes back, you know, as far as you can go. But this North Korea travel warning was another thing. Can I just read this quickly? I mean, do we have?
Yeah, sure.
I'm going to read excerpts from it. It's quite long, but this gives you an idea of how people can be totally brainwashed. All right. This is from May 20th, 2014. This is 9 months after I came back. The Department of State strongly recommends against all travel by U.S. citizens to North Korea, or the DPRK, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Travel by U.S. citizens to North Korea is not routine, and U.S. citizen tourists have been subject to arbitrary arrest and long-term detention. North Korean authorities have arrested U.S. citizens who entered the DPRK legally on DPRK visas, as well as U.S. citizens who accidentally crossed into DPRK territory. The Department of State has also received reports of DPRK authorities arbitrarily detaining U.S. citizens without charges and not allowing them to depart the country. Then further down, penalties for knowingly or unknowingly violating North Korea's laws are much harsher than U.S. penalties for similar offenses. Sentences for crimes can include years of detention in hard labor camps or death. Now, you know, you read stuff like that, and then further on, they strongly urge you, you know, if you really want to go there, register with the U.S. Embassy in Beijing and also contact the North Korea, the Embassy of Sweden in Pyongyang by telephone or email prior to travel. Please provide the Embassy of Sweden with your name, date of birth, dates of your trip, and emergency contact information. I mean, this is all such crap. You know, if anything, if you're dumb enough to get into trouble there, and five or six Americans out of about 7,000 have, did, and all but one blatantly violated the law. So this is just a bunch of propaganda. And as I said, there's absolutely nothing to worry about. By the way, if we want to talk about, you remember Otto Warmbier, the young college kid?
Yeah,
okay, we can talk about that. I don't think it's terribly important, but actually,
let's see if you have any thoughts on the current situation that is continuing with North Korea and all of the escalation, the tension. This has been amped up to a pretty fever pitch at different times within the Trump administration. What do you think is going on here?
I don't know, Kyle. It goes up and down, up and down. Trump has, you know, if you remember, I don't vote, but I did like some things Trump said during the campaign. And this is just one of a million things that he has reversed himself on. I couldn't believe the guy could lie like this, but of course we all know he has. He said he was going to scale back the military presence in Japan and South Korea. And I had a really good feeling when he said that. You know, I thought he was sincere, but obviously he's not sincere. And I don't think he doesn't have a clue what's going on. He's just a playing warrior. Of course, as you know, I mean, during the Vietnam War, he got 5 draft deferments, so somehow his manhood evaded him then. But now he's Mr. Tough Guy. And, you know, I don't know what's going to happen there.
And again, we just can't believe anything that we're seeing. I remember right after he got into office, you had all of these warships, a whole fleet on its way up to North Korea. And then, oh, actually, you know, it's headed in the other direction first. And they're making it seem like there was just going to be imminent bombardment.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like that situation has repeated itself, I think, about a dozen times now. Like imminent war, and then all of a sudden, yeah, let's talk. You know, I'm willing to talk to the guy. And then
Little Rocket Man with his red button.
Yeah, I got a bigger button.
Haven't heard,
yeah, that phrase he's dropped now. So it just goes on and on, back and forth. And we don't even know if, you know, we were told with what Kim Jong-un has said, you know, that, you know, the U.S. better not try it. We're developing our missiles. We don't know if that's all invented, all fabricated.
Well, I mean, so here's the thing. What happens if a country does agree to play nice with the U.S. and give up, let's say, a nuclear program and comply with all of their demands? What happened to Libya?
You're exactly right. Yeah. We know how Gaddafi died. It was pretty ugly.
Yeah.
And I'm sure Kim Jong-un knows very well about that. And so he's so far, you know, he hasn't made a wrong move, I would say. I'll tell you this much. I thought another thing, you know, you said what's going on. I was really hoping with the I was really kind of inspired when during the recent Olympics in South Korea, when they had the unified teams there, I was hoping that that would be a turning point, because my feeling is all that needs to be done just to solve this whole situation is for our military just to pack up and get out of that country, and I think they would be reunified. By the way, do you know how that country was split, how Korea was split apart in the first place? Do you have any idea?
Only an inkling. If you have some details you'd like to share, please do.
Yeah, he at the end of World War II, you know, Korea had been one nation for like about 2,000 years. And at the end of World War II, you know, the Japanese had occupied Korea since 1910. And when he, you know, at the end of the war, after the atomic bombs were dropped, Japan just had to vacate Korea. So, you know, on the day of the Japanese surrender, right around that time, actually, I have this. This is really something to read. You know the name Dean Rusk, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Dean Rusk?
Yes.
He was a military bureaucrat back then, and then he later became Secretary of State in the Johnson and Kennedy administrations. He was given the assignment what to do with Korea once the Japanese got out. So he came up with the idea of splitting the country in half at the 38th parallel and giving the northern half to Joseph Stalin. Let me just quickly read. I'm going to quickly read it from. This is from his memoirs, page 124, as I saw it. There was some disagreement between the U.S. Army and the Department of State over what to do with Korea. So this is what he said. This is what he wrote in his memoirs. We finally reached a compromise that would keep at least some U.S. forces on the Asian mainland, a sort of toehold on the Korean Peninsula for symbolic purposes. During a meeting on August 14, 1945, the same day of the Japanese surrender, Colonel Charles Bonesteel, that was his colleague, and I retired to an adjacent room late at night and studied intently a map of the Korean Peninsula. Working in haste and under great pressure, we had a formidable task to pick a zone for the American occupation. Neither of us was a Korea expert, but it seemed to us that Seoul, the capital, should be in the American sector. We also knew that the U.S. Army opposed an extensive area of occupation. Using a National Geographic map, we looked just north of Seoul for a convenient dividing line, but could not find a natural geographic line. We saw instead the 38th parallel and decided to recommend that. And the Soviet Union accepted that. And that's how that country was ripped in half. The people of Korea had absolutely no say in the matter. The country was ripped apart at the 38th parallel, and that allowed Stalin to, after a couple of years, to his point man in Korea was Kim Il-sung, who was Kim Jong-un's grandfather. And he basically, it took him 3 years to consolidate his power. And that's how Korea was split into North Korea and South Korea.
How could it unify, though? Would it be in a similar way Germany reunified?
Yes. Yeah, I mean the division is so absurd and so artificial. You know, it's like this. And now Korea is a small country geographically. It's the size of Minnesota, so it's kind of like telling people north of Interstate 94 in it's kind of like splitting Minnesota into South Minnesota and North Minnesota. The people north of I-94, they're a communist dictatorship, a brutal communist dictatorship. The people south of I-94 are an American-style consumer democracy. You know, I've been to South Korea as well. You know, it's an okay country. Okay, it's not, it's relatively free. It's much more free and prosperous than the north, of course. But so what you have there is just a completely artificial situation. I mean, it's one country, one people, one language, one race, one culture. I mean, so it's just waiting to be reunified.
But who would give up power? Would the communist regime, the dynasty, would it have some kind of co-rulership over the country? How would they be able to rectify their seemingly diametrically opposed systems of government?
Well, you know, I truly think having been in the country, I really think they have come to realize that their system. You know, the system up there, it's a very, it's a combination of Stalinist, really super hardcore communism, a belief in themselves as a pure race, as the purest race on earth, and the divine personality cult of Kim Jong-un's father and grandfather, with the emphasis on the latter. So that's the kind of ruling ideology there, and I really think they have reached the point where they're ready to throw in the towel. They're like the last super hardcore communist country in the world that's come to realize this doesn't work.
So
we have to make some reforms here.
Might that not be exactly what the New World Order, Jew World Order wants? Because this, from what we're told, especially within the alternative media, the mainstream media doesn't really mention this. North Korea is one of the last countries to not have a Rothschild central bank.
Yes, that's true. That's absolutely true. I think that's why they hate it so much by the Jewish media. They are just independent. I mean, and there's no, they don't want any countries that are independent in the world. There's just a handful left. I know Iran is one of them. Libya was. Yeah, so I don't, it's just a very ticklish situation. But my feeling is if the main sticking point there is really the U.S. military, you know, for the North. Mm-hmm. You know, they're constantly, you know, after what we done, what we did to them, you're right. You know, we absolutely leveled that country. The guy in charge was Air Force General Curtis LeMay, an absolute psychopath. This guy just lived to just drop bombs on people. He did it in Germany and Japan in World War II, and he commanded the air war in North Korea during the Korean War.
Oh, yeah. I have great sympathy for what the North Koreans went through because I've studied fairly in depth, especially producing Hellstorm, what happened to the German people in World War II, and it was basically the same thing that happened to the North Koreans.
You know, the analogy I like to make is this. Imagine filling all of our 30 Major League Baseball stadiums with to capacity with innocent men, women, and children, drenching them with gasoline and tossing a lit match on them. That's pretty much what we did in North Korea. We pretty much used that country. You know, napalm was a pretty recent invention at that time. It was used at the end of a little bit at the end of World War II, but they really wanted to see what it could do, you know, on a large scale. And we just... We just dropped so much napalm on that country. We burned, you know, I don't even know. You talk about numbers. Nobody really knows.
Right.
Close to 1 million people, I think, were burned alive by napalm in that country.
And then they used lots of napalm in Vietnam, too.
In Vietnam, too. But I probably more in Korea. And you could see the old, you know, when I was there, I said to myself, you know, every person I'm looking at here, The parents or grandparents of every person in this country either died in the Korean War or lost everything they had. I mean, they had been through so much hell. And you could see it in the older people. You could see it in their faces. They're just worn out. You know, and of course, not only the war, but everything after that, just living under such a very, very repressive system and just being bombarded with this propaganda day in and day out, this whole divine personality cult thing. But as I said, I think some of the people at Young Pioneer Tours who had been doing tours there for a few years said that they've seen some changes that they couldn't have imagined a couple of years ago. You know, just to give you a small example, I didn't expect to see this, but in the main square there in Pyongyang, we saw a lot of kids rollerblading, and the guides with Young Pioneer Tours said you couldn't see this a couple of years ago. I mean, so they do seem to be loosening up a little bit in small ways. But I also have to say they have a beautiful culture. What you never see on TV is the woman in the beautiful folk dresses. Their music is very lovely. Their art, I mean, they really have preserved their culture to a very admirable degree. And you don't see that in the South. I didn't see it. I was in the South in 1980. The South is just, you know, kind of an Americanized consumer society. But again, you know, they really have to try to strike that balance of giving the people some, you know, because the Koreans, let's face it, they're a law abiding, they're hard working people. I mean, they're a good people, you know, in their own country. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, we don't always see that in the Koreans in the United States. Some of the people.
No, no.
Yeah.
No. So, you know, I think, as I said earlier, I think they've come to the realization that they have to make some reforms because the people have just suffered enough. I mean, they can't go on living under the same system for too much longer.
Hmm.
But you know, if the country is reunified again, I don't know. You know, I don't know how you feel about this. I think the whole, I think Russia and the alliance between Russia and China is really, maybe I'm a little naive about this, I don't know, but I think they have really thrown up an obstacle in the path of the Jewish New World Order.
I think that's the new Jew World Order. The Jews had their hands in China for a long time, and they never really gave it up in Russia. And that's one thing that is just consistent between any of these ruling regimes, whether it's the United States or Russia, is that you've got these Jewish supremacists like Chabad Lubavitch basically having an incredible amount of power and influence over the elected leaders. And in the United States, this goes between the different parties as well. You've got Chabad Lubavitch having a huge influence over the Democrats and the Republicans, and AIPAC, you know, being a manifestation of this kind of Jewish power, where you've got both the Democrats and Republicans coming together for one thing. Isn't it just amazing? They seem to just be at each other's throats on so many different issues, but on this one issue, they're just so united. But that unity that we see between these warring forces could be, you know, shown between different countries as well, is what I'm saying, where it seems like they are battling against each other, you know, in some kind of cold war, jockeying for position. But I do think a lot of this is just political theater. And at the end of the day, the same forces are controlling both hands, the left and the right, or the east and the west.
Well, I certainly think that certainly applies to the U.S. I mean, that's I've known that for a long time. You might be right about the whole Russia-China alliance, and which I think Korea is going to be a part of eventually. I hope you're not right.
Well, it would be nice. It would be nice if there were actually governments of this world that weren't part of the conspiracy against us. I just don't hold out any hope from it, given all the evidence that I've seen thus far. And with North and South Korea, it's kind of one of these dialectics, isn't it, where it's like you can either choose to be part of the repressive kind of East German Stasi-type state, you know, which would be the North, or the liberalized Southern state, which was like West Germany.
Right, yeah.
You know, and those shouldn't be the options, the only options. Neither of those leads to a healthy and happy people. You see the flaws in both and the kind of flawed individuals that it produces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I totally agree. I mean, I would like to see them strike that ideal balance between prosperity and a really healthy kind of a national outlook and a healthy individual outlook.
Mm-hmm.
But
Did you see a lot of the decadence in the South? The kind of
I'm sorry.
Did you see a lot of the decadence in the South and the effeminization of the men, the K-pop and everything? Was that really visible to you?
No, I was in the South. I was there for like 4 or 5 days in 1980. No, I really didn't see that.
Okay.
I didn't see any decadence. What stands out in my mind really was just being in Seoul and just seeing like KFC and McDonald's,
yeah,
that kind of thing. You know, Seoul is just a big modern industrial, you know, not a very it didn't have much of a Korean atmosphere. Let me put it that way.
Yeah. Well,
no, but it did get out to the countryside. It did have a real Korean identity. But
I hope that's still the case, because I've seen some documentaries, read some news stories. They're big into these kind of planned, futuristic type cities, and all technologically and advanced. You know, looking into the microchipping and smart this and smart that. It seems like they're actually ahead of the United States in that regard. And ahead, I mean progressive, but not in a way that I would like to go.
Not in a healthy way.
Yes, yes. And
right.
it really is, you know, full social engineering of the youth. And there's just incredible internet addiction. A lot of these people are just gamers, spending all their time online. But again, I've never been there. I haven't interacted with them, and you haven't been there for a while either. So I don't know what the real boots on the ground type situation is. It's just unfortunate to see people repressed or seemingly let loose from that repression so as to be able to go off and just degenerate and use their free choice to make all the wrong decisions.
Well, yeah, you know, there's something about the East Asian mentality too that's kind of like that. They're kind of a reg. They have a reg. I was in Japan, you know, around the same time I was that I went to South Korea, and you know, Japan is a very, very wonderful people, very admirable people, but they do have that kind of regimented collectivist mentality. I mean, there's I don't know how to describe it. They are a different race. You know, the Chinese as well. I mean, they probably surpassed everybody in all this, you know, using their smartphones for everything. From what I've read, they've almost become a cashless society now, China. I mean, just everything is done with their phone, and you know, a lot of cameras. They're very, very into, like you said, into the just, you know, advancing technology further and further, and really for no really healthy reasons.
India made a huge step going cashless in many regards, basically confiscating cash. That's what it was at the end of the day. And I think that the United States is very close to that. And just a little bit of a financial shakeup could be the problem that causes the you know, reaction solution chain to then we end up, well, you no longer have cash. And hey, we've actually got some blockchain or cryptocurrencies you could use as well. We're fine with that, but pretty much we're going to have everything on a chip. So I see us going in that direction soon, and you could look at the countries of the East as that kind of model that they have in store for us. And that includes grabbing the guns, and we've seen Trump make many overtures towards doing just that, saying, I'd like to take the guns first and worry about due process later, basically saying there will be no due process. So it's very alarming when you see some of that kind of communist rhetoric being openly discussed. The First and Second Amendments being completely flaunted here at home, like they are not important whatsoever, and they don't even need to pass laws or to make amendments to take them away from us. They'll just do it by fiat, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Well, what Trump said just a few days ago about guns, that really threw me for a loop, too. Nothing surprises me about him anymore. So, but I think that the few people, you know, of the 63 million people who voted for him, I don't know. What are your feelings about how many people do you think among those have become completely disillusioned with him?
I hope it's a lot, but unfortunately, I feel too. Like in this dialectic, they're forced to just kind of stand by their man. And, you know, oh, well, he's not as bad as Hillary would have been. At least we don't have Hillary. And they're pushing this 4D chess QAnon type thing really, really hard to keep people roped back in and thinking that this is just his brilliant strategy. You think he's appeasing these people, but really he's still on our side and he'll come through in the end.
That's getting pretty old, you know. I thought that might have been a possibility maybe 8 months ago, but certainly you know, not anymore. But you know, I'm just curious, just to go back to, you know, I was going on the internet a little while ago. Do you think, as far as Putin goes, I would like to really think, well, let me ask you this, for example. This seems to be inconsistent with what a lot of people say, that he's just doing the bidding for the Jews. How about when he met up with Solzhenitsyn? You know about Solzhenitsyn's book.
I do, yes.
200, you know, it hasn't been translated into English, as far as I know, has it?
That one, no. Gulag Archipelago has been translated.
Yeah, that I read a long time ago. But 200 Years Together was really focused on the Jews. And there's a famous picture of him shaking hands with Solzhenitsyn just before Solzhenitsyn died. So Putin must know. Of course, he knows what the Jews did to Russia. You know, beginning in 1917 and right through Basically, right through the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991.
Anybody who's paying attention should know that.
Yeah.
Especially if you're in Russia, yes. But they have censored history. So I don't know what the average Russian actually knows about the nature of the Bolsheviks. But anybody who's paying attention, like Winston Churchill was when he wrote Zionism versus Bolshevism article, where even he, the completely philo-Semitic, fat, disgusting psychopath, admitted that Bolshevism is completely Jewish.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. But I'm just wondering, how do you see then that there was one woman in the Knesset who said something who really threatened Putin. And now, do you think that was all theater? She said something to the effect that he better watch his step or we're just going to get rid of him. Meaning that we're going to kill him.
What result was there? Putin dons a yarmulke, goes to the Wailing Wall. He went to Yad Vashem and said, basically, boo-hoo, I'm so sorry about all the dead Jews. And then, he made a promise, essentially, to take care of the Holocaust deniers. He went back to his country, outlawed criticism of the Red Army. Also questioning the Holocaust in any degree, completely outlawed in Russia. And you're not even allowed to make anti-Semitic biblical commentary. And people like to think that the traditional Russian church is just this bastion white Christianity. Oh yeah, that's all completely true. And this happened in the past few years. Banning of nationalistic symbols.
I didn't know that.
Oh yeah. Basically, what we still kind of have here in the West, especially the United States, in terms of free speech and ability to own arms. If we were in Russia doing the same thing, we could be locked up many, many, many times over. So for us to look there for any kind of hope, I think would be fruitless.
All right. I have to do my homework then. I didn't know.
You wouldn't hear people in the alternative media saying that, because what they do is they see how the mainstream media's narrative about Russiagate is a lot of junk. But they're not dealing with the actual connections that Trump has to Russia, because that would expose the Chabad Mafia, Chabad Lubavitch, people like Felix Sater, and the many, many other people like Arif, who he has been tied to for so very long. I mean, you have Kushner being a member of this Chabad Lubavitch sect, and also Sheriff Israel down here in Parkland, Florida, being a Chabad member, and that town being a complete Chabad hotbed. It's very obvious, actually, what's going on. And Chabad is a Russian Jewish movement. Russia is the besides Brooklyn, I mean, Russia and Brooklyn kind of fight over who's really, in control of it. It seems it's not a real fight. They're still all Chabad. But Putin actually wouldn't let the Rebbe Schneerson Library go to New York. He kept it in Moscow. That's how much Chabad Lubavitch means to him. He wants to have the Rebbe Schneerson Library there. And I don't know if you know about Rebbe Schneerson. This guy was seen as the Messiah to these Chabad freaks. This was actually the guy that was honored in that bill passed by George H.W. Bush. Was it 91, where he declared National Education Day to be Rebbe Schneerson Day, but also instituted the 7 Noahide laws in the United States in a really backdoor kind of fashion. Saying that we recognize the Noahide laws being a guiding principle. If you actually look at the 7 Noahide laws, what it amounts to is if you get accused by a Jew, that's basically a death sentence, and you get your head chopped off.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of control they have.
I remember the Rabbi Schneerson thing vaguely. I've been following what's been going on in the States with that, but I really, as I said, I'm pretty ignorant about the developments in Russia that you would. I didn't even know that Putin went through the Wailing Wall and put a yarmulke.
Oh yeah,
I didn't know that.
If you've seen the pictures of Putin being surrounded by Jews, and they're all dressed up in the suits and the hats, That's Chabad. It's the same thing with George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush. Have you ever seen those pictures of them sitting there signing legislation with a bunch of Jews behind them? That's Chabad. Or Rick Perry when he was dancing around this table with a bunch of Hasidic Jews singing some Jewish song. That was Chabad. It's just that the so-called truth tellers out there who are shilling for people like Donald Trump, like InfoWars, they don't connect the dots there for you. Actually, Alex Jones, after Trump got elected, as he was getting elected, he was sitting there dancing with these guys. I wouldn't be surprised if they were Chabad. They were all wearing the Make America Great hat on. It was Trump and some Jews just celebrating their guy winning the highest office in the whole wide world. Isn't it just incredible? For people to think that this position, being the emperor of Zog, could ever go to somebody who wasn't completely in line with Jewish interests, that's just completely absurd.
Mm-hmm.
But we think that we're free, and North Korea is being bombarded by propaganda. And the only thing is that in North Korea, there's only one kind of acceptable line. We get divided up into fighting each other over which Jewish puppet is going to rule us here.
Mm-hmm.
Oh man.
Yeah.
But at least we're free.
Yes, but with quote unquote free.
Yeah, then they've moved hard, banning all the Holocaust books on Amazon.
Yeah, I know, it's getting pretty bad.
Yeah.
Now, it wouldn't surprise me if Trump just turns around and makes Holocaust denial a federal offense.
Well, in the Soviet Union,
a mandatory 10-year jail sentence.
Yeah. 10 years.
Nothing about this guy would surprise me anymore.
Yeah, 10 years. That's nothing compared to what the Soviet Union did. They just executed people for anti-Semitism.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then they threw him into psych wards, just tortured them with psychiatric treatments and drugs.
Yes, I know about that. I know about that horrible history. I know.
Yeah.
But we do have the alternative media, and I'd like to know. I have to say, I don't know up here. I don't know too many people who go onto it, but just looking at the comments and all the different websites, I mean, there are people out there who are waking up, but I've heard that for a long time. People are waking up, and I think it's just going to take people getting going hungry, and everything breaking down.
I hope not, because I don't want to go hungry, and I want my family to go hungry,
and I don't want my stuff
breaking down. But what is it going to take for these people to actually finally have had enough? At least say something about it, and then let's say we do something about it, because we've been basically assaulted in so many different ways, and they're leading us toward the end of times. If we don't intervene, that will be the end of everything. It'll be their little Armageddon that they get to have, where we all essentially die or become their slaves. That's what they see in the end times, and that's what is unfolding here before our eyes. And North Korea has definitely been a part of that, where this is given as something for us to consider, that we could all be blown to bits in an instant if North Korea attacks us. And, we might need to destroy North Korea, just completely obliterate the entire country and its people. That's what has been threatened against them. It's absolutely insane. Insane world where we're accepting as being legitimate at any level. Mm-hmm. But anything you'd like to conclude with here in the last few minutes before we have to close out?
Would I like to conclude? Let me just see here. I would actually. There was one article. Very few people know about it. Are you familiar with Pete McCloskey? Paul McCloskey, actually.
No,
he was his nickname. He's a congressman from California. He's 90 years old now, and he was kind of a maverick in Congress, and he was a Korean War veteran. And you can look up this. It's kind of an uplifting article to read. This really should have been on the broadcast news, but it never was. It only made it in a couple of California newspapers. That's his home state. The name of the heading on the article is War Hero, Pete McCloskey Back from Reunion in North Korea. Now, he went there 4 years ago. He was on some kind of mission, some kind of project to see if he could open up commercial ties. And by chance, he ran into a 3-star North Korean general named Ji Young-chun. And, you know, I'm looking at the article right here. I printed it from the internet. And there was a young female soldier who interpreted it. And they just began reminiscing about now, this general had also fought in the Korean War. And like McCloskey, he had been wounded in action. McCloskey was wounded twice. I think this guy was wounded 3 times. And they just started reminiscing, you know, through the interpreter. And they ended up embracing each other, and with tears in their eyes, they vowed that their grandchildren and their great grandchildren would never fight each other in a war. So that really, to me, that kind of symbolizes what the attitude over there. You know, it's even from the military. I mean, they do not. They will definitely defend their country furiously, but they do not want to start a war with us. You know, they've been through it. And then when McCloskey got back to the States, he said something. The first thing he said to a reporter was, "I feel I've had an experience I've wanted to have for 64 years, which is to shake hands with one of the young kids I fought against and tell them how bravely they fought." Now, you know, to me, that just, there's a nobility of the heart there and a code of chivalry that you that is so rare today. And this guy was a guy, he was a Marine platoon leader. He just quietly enlisted in the Marines. He did what he thought was right for his country. And, you know, and he fought there, not like so many of these other guys, like Trump.
Hey, John, we've run out of time. Thanks so much for joining me here. Appreciate the conversation.
All right, Kyle. Thank you.
Okay, take care. Thanks for listening.
All right, bye-bye.
Thanks to supporters as well. What happened to the individual? What happened to working class white? The feathers had with so much propaganda.
Jews control money, government, media, and academia. Repeat.
Jews are poor. The government and media are anti-Semitic.
Hola! You've just heard Chosen, one of the oldest languages known to ape. Try another. Mayenta is fat, ugly, and Sephardi.
My wife is beautiful, intelligent, and spiritual.
Good job! We have Chosen learning pods in synagogues, lodges, even selected pizza restaurants. Learn Chosen and stay ahead.
Vaccines are safe. The Holocaust was real.
So fluent, so Chosen. Fees, obligations, and genital mutilation apply.
He saw the man.